dead silence.
So why don't you start by identifying yourself?
Irene Soloway, and I'm a carpenter with the United Brotherhood of Carpenters. Currently working for the past 4.5 years for New York City as a city carpenter for the Health and Hospitals Corporation.
How did you decide that you wanted to apply for membership in a union?
1978, had recently moved back to the city from where I had been living in St. Louis and doing odd jobs after going to art school for a while and finding it difficult to make a living, having no marketable skills. Having done painting and worked in a bar and with a bunch of roofers as bar patrons, and they used to come in hot and sweaty, and I had to put up with a pawing boss. And one day I just quit, and they gave me their roofing hammer, one of their roofing hammers, and as a joke, but I actually sort of made me want to go do it just to show them. So I actually started doing some roofing, which was hot and horrible and heavy work, and then, you know, but ended up from there house painting, and from there furniture stripping, and from there I worked in a boat yard in New York City, and then the unions opened up their doors to women and in an organized fashion about the time I was making $4 an hour working as a laborer in a boatyard. And I thought, well, this is perfect. It's a chance to make some money and actually in a formal way learn a trade that I've been taking stabs at. And better yet, there was an organized kind of women's group at the time called Women in Apprenticeship Program, headed by a woman named Mary Garvin, who was a carpenter in California who had moved to New York with this idea in mind to facilitate women getting in the union. And so she kind of knew something about the trades. She wasn't just some kind of professional social workery type person. And she organized, all kinds of us from all different backgrounds ended up sitting in this room filling out applications and getting little pep talks about how it could be possible and how you do things and how you manipulate yourself in this arena that was totally unfamiliar to all of us.
Did she have any relationship with the unions?
She had done some groundwork. I don't know all the details of it, but she had done some groundwork in talking to various union heads, and it was a combination of, it was time to do this thing, which is to formally take in women into these apprenticeship programs. There was an executive order, 11426, that came, that had come down out of Carter, I think it was, the Carter administration, and it said that they had goals and timetables for women on jobs that were federally funded, a 6.9 apprenticeship goal, and it was at 6.9 on federally funded job sites and a 20% in the apprenticeship, and there was the contractors were alerted that they would need women to be able to get these jobs, and the unions were supposed to supply them, and Mary Garvin and company was able to facilitate getting the women to the union. So I came into that situation. And
so in all the years you've been in the trades, Irene, how many years?
1979 was formal apprenticeship, and before that it was a couple of years of odd jobs.
Right. And so have you ever seen 20% of a carpenter's class, class, female? Have you ever seen 6.9% of a federal
I've ever seen was, there were one job, a large job, which was 80 Broad Street downtown, which was 40-floor office tower from the ground up, And I saw there were six women out of a crew of maybe, I don't know, 500 or 600. And that to me seemed like, you know, it was unbelievable, you know, that we were all in the same job at the same time. As far as apprenticeship goes, I don't know what percentages there are, but of course there has not, I mean, I don't know if anyone really believed that there would be 20% women apprentices or almost 7% of any particular construction job. That's 7 out of 100. That's a lot. I mean, that's still like a very unbelievable figure. I don't think anyone's seen that in New York City. 7 out of 100.
So when you started working, what was the difference in money that you
had made? Mm-hmm. Well, I thought first year apprenticeship, all these apprentices were complaining about how low the apprenticeship starting pay was, but it was more than I had ever made in my life. I didn't admit, you know, I would too embarrassed to say, oh, this is great. You know, it wasn't great, but it was definitely better than I had been making minimum wage. My better job actually was working as a waitress rather than working non-union as a tradesperson.
So what was the response of the union?
Well, it was hard to say at first because we had that situation with the hunting licenses.
Yes,
so we weren't really in the union. We were outside the union with a letter of that's consented that we go onto construction sites and look for a job. Maybe we should test this. I'm little nervous because. Okay, this is a great little machine. It really records very clearly. Okay.
So, you finally started working union.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to describe the reaction of your co-workers and the bosses when women showed up on the sites?
When I started, it was, I think it was as difficult as it could be in terms of that there weren't any women before we started, that most men had never worked with any women, and it was totally a strange thing for us and a totally strange thing for them. And all of us were completely green in terms of not knowing. Mary Garvin and tried to give us a little sense, but she was talking about California, not New York, and told us all kinds of things that really weren't true. Like she had told us that if you use non-union tools or wear non-union clothing, you'll be shunned as a worker from the job site. And of course, the first thing you notice is everybody's using Craftsman tools and no driving Volkswagens to work it was a little disturbing, when you ask people about why they were using non-union tools, they looked at you like you had two heads, because you can use the same level for the 30 years and Craftsman will refund your money cheerfully. The rules were different. They were New York rules. And in terms of coming on as a female, I can only, thinking back and seeing myself as a green in New York, I was a new Jewish New York lesbian from a middle class background, feminist, and I was from a completely another world, and I thought as a feminist that these men were supposed to be nice to me and help me and be kind, and I was very naive, I really deep in my heart thought that they were the enemy and I was infiltrating their territory, and that I should just be very forthright and demand my rights, and that I didn't really think about what was supposed to happen. I just thought it was just a kind of a battlefield or something. And thinking back on it, I was extremely naive to think that they were supposed to I was supposed to be able to call the rules, and they were supposed to act in a way that was to my liking, and that it was really all defense because I was in their world and I was green and I didn't know anything. And I was also had this sort of feminist training that I'm supposed to have a lot of a large self-esteem. When you're starting as an apprentice in construction, you should have some internal self-esteem, but basically you're an ignorant person who has everything to learn, and you rely very much on people who teach you. And that whole give and take was not, I think there was a lot of interference. So there was the fact that they were, there was a certain amount of hostility and from the men, but there was also a lot of hostility from me. And I acknowledge that now. I acknowledge that after a couple of years. That was a number one important lesson that I had to learn.
How long did it take to learn?
It took too long because I was old when I started in construction. I was 25, 26. So I was supposed to, I was a full-grown woman and I wanted to be treated in a certain way. And it would have been more helpful to have started when I was 18 or 19 in a certain way, because I would have just been this dumb kid instead of being a smart woman in a situation so alien and not being able to really be humble enough to say, I'm just might as well be a dumb kid in this situation. I don't want to get too psychological, but until I can find a way to use what I do know, to let that sit on the side and just learn things as it comes to me, and not. So I believe that there was just a lot of interference when I first started in construction, and I could have learned more if I was just more relaxed and more able to be ignorant, as I had the right to be ignorant. All apprentices start ignorant, but because I assumed that my expectation would be that, I was supposed to prove myself right away, and I was supposed to show that I was extremely strong and competent. Now I realize that nobody is really when they start, and it's okay as long as you're willing to learn. So that's, in terms of advice to others, I really think that if you can start out like acknowledging your ignorance, and it would be more helpful than to try to prove how smart you are.
I'm all right, you're all right.
What?
I'm all right, you're all right. What was the response of the union, and how did you first start to... how did you see the union?
Well, I had never been in a union before. Most of the people that I came in with, most of the women had never been in a union before. I was very excited about being in a union because I believed that they were this force that was going to, a structure that was supposed to support me as a worker and teach me, and that I could rely on certain things, protection against employers that were unfair and this type of thing. And I was excited about going to union meetings. I thought the whole thing was great.
What kind of role did you play at union meetings? Did you ever talk?
Well, I said I thought the whole thing was great initially. I joined a local, which was a powerful New York City local, and very undemocratic and very strong power base for very few people who ran the local and their henchmen. And I learned very quickly that the union meetings weren't for us, weren't for the rank and file. And the union itself, there were real limits on what the rank and file was supposed to expect of the union. And so that was another big lesson in the lowering expectations about what a union was. in this, in what my union was anyway.
How did you go to the union meetings? Did you go with people you worked with? Did you hook up with these other women who were new to the...
There were, at that point, no other women in my local that I knew. So I was, consistently for 3 or 4 years, the only woman that I saw at another, at a union meeting. I went to every single one for 5 years, which was one, I think it was this second Monday of the month, or the first Monday of the month. And it was very difficult. I would go, and there would be the, what I could call the lappers and the clappers and the goons all standing around outside, staring at you. And you walked up the street, went alone, every meeting I went alone. I tried to find somebody to sit with who I knew. I was extremely alienated. The whole purpose of the meeting seemed to be to cheer the business agents, whatever they'd say. Nobody listened to the minutes. The minutes were unrecognizable. Nobody ever spoke from the floor in 5 years, and except for to either ask for a standing ovation for the business agents or to vote in a raise for the business agents. And I was told by other people I knew who had been in longer that that was to not expect any different and dare not ever speak from the floor in that local, that it was, that there had been many battles of people who had tried to insert their own agenda onto local meetings, who had tried to run for office, who had tried different things, and I heard unspecific stories of violence and destroyed lives. And those stories were repeated all the time to me whenever I questioned why these meetings were so completely dead. I used to compare them to what Mussolini's Italy used to be like. You know, it was fascism in action as far as I was concerned. And I went to all of them because I thought this is what, somehow I can't not, I mean, this is the only level that I could participate in is by sitting there and observing this. And I observe it, and I feel like I bear witness to this. Now, I'm glad I went for all those years. I can say I did. I went for 5 years, and nobody ever spoke from the floor. And the only role of the rank and file member was to be a completely subservient and silent, except for expected responses, which were always affirmative for the business agents. And I think it's still to this day right like that, but I'm not sure because I stopped going.
How would you characterize the difference between the union at the union meetings and the union on your shop floor, the union in the workplace?
Well, to tell you the truth, I found that it extended, the fear and the intimidation extended to the workplace in my experience. And when people were very much on the work site, intimidated to talk about specific problems they had with people in my local did, because they have, because of the structure, the shop stewards are appointed and they are the eyes and ears of the business agent, and if you are really outspoken, then you end up with problems. So I found that there was a lot of intimidation on the job also, and people didn't speak freely about problems they had. And there was a lot of cynicism. I mean, people, when they talk about the meetings and they talk about the business agents, it was there out of a local of I don't know, maybe it was 10,000 people at that time. The average meeting was 50 people. Because most people who were decent people didn't bother going. Diehards like me went, and then these other people who were trying to curry favor and get jobs and, you know. So most people didn't go. Most people threw up their hands. And so there was not a lot of discussion about that on that level, unionism.
So So moving from this deadening atmosphere, cynicism,
so,
fear,
yeah,
and apathy. How would you...
I should say at this point something, because the apprenticeship school was another place where the union was evident. Apprenticeship school was run by this union, and was also had a board of directors, which was an employers and union. But it was another aspect of the union that we were exposed to.
And
we went
there
twice a week in a different atmosphere, which was not, it was in some ways supportive of us as apprentices. The place, it was not a perfect place, but it was, and especially I feel for the women and the women that I came in with in the school at that time, we did feel that we had a, that we belonged in terms of apprenticeship school. There was nobody who was saying to us we shouldn't be there. The administrators at the time were supportive of us personally and as women, wanted us to succeed in the industry. And there was an administrator named Mr. Dickinson who was he was very supportive of the women. Charles Fanning was very, he wanted apprentices to succeed. That was his purpose. And we were apprentices, so he wanted us to succeed. And so that was it wasn't a hotbed of a debate, but it was a place where it was a positive, somewhat positive atmosphere. There were some of us who got together and tried to put in our suggestions of things that we thought would make things more, that would make sense to us to want to learn, that was not part of the agenda of the school. For example, union contract, and we had to read your contract and history of the local and some kind of awareness
that was
sessions
part of the curriculum?
No, it was not. Sessions on sexual harassment of women, so that men, at least apprentice men, would learn that this was not correct, and we brought these issues to the director of the school, and we wanted to have committees of, we started organizing then around those issues, and found that we weren't very successful at the time, but have learned since that they actually do have, some of those things have been instituted since I was an apprentice. They have a labor history class that apparently some people are very, very excited about.
Do they do training about sexual harassment?
I don't know if they did that, but they did. They have pursued avenues to integrate women better into. They have a pre-apprenticeship for women that they've opened up their school to women who are trying to get into the union to familiarize so that they will be able to succeed. They've done certain things. I don't know if they ever had the sexual harassment trainings. They should. They really should. But they do have the union history classes, and that's something.
So you started your role as an organizer in the union back then when you were an apprentice. Stirring things up, asking questions, saying this is how we can improve our situation.
Right. We went and we asked for a women's committee. We all these things that just made sense. We weren't trying to be radicals at all. We just thought we could get these things. But they made complete sense to us.
Right.
So, they were completely reasonable. But what we learned was there is no committee structure in our union. And so we would have been the first committee. And so that was a very big step for the union to take that they weren't willing, and they still, as yet, are not willing to take. So it was more, there was nothing to hook into in terms of, we had to, of being able to participate. Mm-hmm. Wow. It's like two-thirds through here. You can watch it. You're the interviewer. I'm the interviewee.
So what was the first, if you could think back, action that you took on the job to bring people together and to use the union as some kind of a lever or to work somehow to improve a workplace situation?
I have friends who did those things. I don't think I did those things. I could tell you about them and what they did.
Well, I'd like you to tell me about you, because as I've known you, you've been Irene, the organizer, working for improving health and safety conditions, and you've been working as a steward.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Well, actually, we're going to skip many years then. We're going to skip over to the present, or the last 4 or 5 years.
I'm interested in learning about how you got to the point where you felt comfortable enough to take that role. What spurred you on to leading?
Okay, well, very specifically, when I started working for the city and I got out from under the structure, the hiring hall structure, I felt my job was not in such jeopardy that I couldn't speak my mind out, and I got elected steward, which
working
was not
in the civil service.
Right, within the civil service, they have elected stewards and not appointed stewards, and so I got elected steward, which was no big thing because.
Did that come from you? Did you put yourself up for that? Or
well, actually, I had started to become very vocal about we work in 15 city hospitals. There's asbestos in at least, well, actually 15 out of 17 sites that we work on. And we had no education about it, but I had some education about it myself. And so I started basically refusing to work in an unsafe area that was contaminated with asbestos when I knew it. I started to get a reputation because I actually took a stand on that and management was not prepared for it, so they had to deal with it. And so it was that point where I was asked, they had a steward. There was a steward who was on the job, and I at that point about 4 or 5 men came to me and asked me to run for steward. They wanted me as steward and they didn't want him anymore. Because I think it was around that they really felt like, well, I stuck my neck out. I had no choice as far, and so they figured, well, she'll be good as a steward because she's not afraid to do that, and maybe she'll do that for us. And so that's what happened. We had an election, so I became steward that way.
So they assumed that because you did it, you had no fear. Is that actually the case? How did you feel?
Well, in terms of asbestos, at that, I was just like an enraged person. I mean, there's just nothing. I could not. It was just knowledge. I couldn't put that knowledge that I had about asbestos on the side. I didn't care. I mean, it was the one issue that can just make me act like a lunatic. So I didn't care really. But there are other issues that I am much more difficult for me. That's a pretty clear-cut one for me. I know enough to know what's right in that situation. You want to turn it over, or you want to run it out?
Run it out.
I can't. You're kind of
really getting down there now.
Uh-huh. So anyway, that was that story, and the first meeting that I got elected steward, one guy told me to go fuck myself and walked out of the room and everybody laughed and said, how do you like being steward so far, you know?
What was his, did he have some particular grievance, or?
Well, this is funny, I don't know, it doesn't have that much to do with the issue, but it was around the issue I was trying to get one of the men, since I was supposed to run the meeting as steward after being elected, I was trying to get one of the men to take notes, and Adam, and the only man who was willing to take notes was drunk out of his mind.
Yeah. Now it's going.
Okay. I think we got this down to a soft science.
Okay.
So,
good.
Okay.
So, what kind of grievances were you handling?
Well, we don't have grievance procedure.
We don't have a contract.
And we don't have a contract. And
how did you start learning how to be steward?
Well, I'm learning how to and how not to now. There's no formal training. I think that for me, being a steward is real important. To me, my personal view, the union didn't appoint me. According to the union, the steward's role is to represent workers to the union, bring issues to the union of various nature, and let the union will then deal with it. I found that in our particular situation, and I know this is not unique to us, that it's not often the case that those issues will be dealt with in a way that went for us actually on the job. It's we don't often get our
remedy.
So we have to be creative.
The carpenters have a different concept of steward, rather as a conduit and a messenger, rather than as an advocate in fighting on the first level, fighting in the trenches.
Right. Well, because in outside construction, I'm not civil service construction, the steward is. There's so many roles that a steward has that doesn't have to do with representing a man. It has to do with making, a lot of corrupt activities, as well as, and really taking direct orders from the VAs in terms of what to do and what not to do in any given situation. There are some good stewards who do try to get people their pay, their stamps, not that they don't get laid off inappropriately, and we'll take on fights. Those are the people who are just good people who aren't stopped from being from doing that. In the city, we don't have as important a role in terms of the industry, in terms of a lot of the role that a lot of the stewards have in terms of making sure a job is union, and making sure being told not to care about that, making sure that the job is 50-50, local men and company men, lots of different safety things, lots of different political things. We don't have that role. We're just kind of there, and so you kind of define your own, to me, I feel what's really important is that in our workplace, we have, just like workplaces everywhere, every day there are challenges to us in terms of, there are challenges to our integrity as human beings, and that it's real important to maintain integrity and strength as a group of workers, because our bosses, just like bosses everywhere, are really trying to needle us down to be very passive, and to break our own union rules, and to break our own codes of honor, and all of that stuff. And to me, I tell men that I work with, and anyone who's interested in knowing, that there are standards that we have to hold on the job. And that if we don't hold them, they can always hurt us more. And so I feel like that's my job, which is now I'm not defining in a very specific way, but it's to see ourselves as a work unit, to see ourselves as having some integrity as a work unit, as carpenters, to identify problems that are our problems and to try to come up with solutions. And then if we can't deal with them ourselves, then we would try to get help from our union. And if the union won't help us, then we have to try to demand help from our union. So it's in that order that, you know, that I see things working.
Now, how do you communicate with your coworkers when you're spread out between 15 hospitals and you're working in all different kinds of work groups? How do you find ways to communicate?
Well, when I got elected steward, I said to the men that I won't do it unless we have some way of getting together on a regular basis, that there's some communication, because there's no way. I mean, I might not see a particular guy for a year, a carpenter. So originally, they of course, making it easy on themselves, they wanted me to call all the jobs once a week to find out what was going on. Now, there's nothing in my contract that says I have the right to take time off of work to call around 15 jobs and find out what's going on. So that didn't work out too well. We did agree from the very beginning, though, to have meetings, quarterly meetings, to be able to discuss any problem that was still a standout, and to get together. So what we do is we do that. Well, every 3 months we have a meeting after work on our own time and in a specific place, and the men call them union meetings, but they're not on union territory. They're really carpenter meetings for our shop, and they're real helpful because people, I would say two-thirds of the carpenters come to them. They get very good attendance. There's a lot of, they're very important to people. Whenever there's a meeting, the people are working at trying to get other people to go to them. It's become an indication of whether somebody is really a team player, is whether they come to these meetings, and everybody gets to speak. Problems are identified, and some of the real problems are problems that we are struggling to deal with each time, like the issue of getting the proper protective equipment, proper masks, getting training under the Right to Know law. It's still, we've been battling this, and each time I don't bring it up, the men bring it up, and then we vote on what is appropriate action to take. There are lots of problems with management and chain of command and jurisdictional problems, and these, you know, people speak on these things, and we try to come up with solutions. And this is, they're really good meetings. They're, compared to local XXX, they're very democratic, and we always come up with at least one or two proposals, and that gives me as steward a mandate to go ahead. And I don't do it unless there is a mandate to go ahead, because I told them at the very beginning, there's this, unless you're willing to put yourselves on a line, I know how to fight for myself, and I can fight for myself, but if you want something, you have to put your name behind it, you have to put your body on the line, and so that's, there's nothing that I do as steward that isn't from a consensus of the people I work with. Yeah, thanks. And there hasn't been very much that, you know, concretely we've accomplished. I mean, we've put in some complaints with the Department of Labor. We've used a lot of peer group pressure. We come back from the meetings, and the other trades all want to know what happened. We're the only trade that has our own meetings, and so what we say sets a tone. There's a lot of things that I can't really say are concrete. but that make a big difference to a lot of us in terms of that we feel like, you know, we're carpenters, we're not, you know, we have opinions, we can support each other in some way on, you know, and not be completely confused all the time about what's happening to us. We can identify when we have a bad management problem. We figure out how do you deal with these type of people, so to me that's been my most, you know, to me, and I think I'm, you know, I think to some of the guys too. You know, it's just we're building some kind of basis for solidarity, and I think it extends to the other trades, but we're building some kind of basis of respect for each other. And I just think it takes a long time when you come from a situation where this isn't something that it's not, it's something that's almost been beat out of you. And so I feel like it is slow. It is slow, but there is, you know, there's a consciousness that we're building that I think will serve us well if we continue in the future. I think it has already served us well in ways that it sounds abstract, but I'd have to describe to you all these like minute little boring things that happen to us on the job and how we deal with them. You know, there's nothing very dramatic. The only thing, you know, pretty dramatic is around the asbestos stuff, and I think we've taken a very, you know, we've not consistently, but it's really been a big issue, and I think management has reacted to our to us in a big way, and I think things have gotten somewhat better.
What's changed since you started doing it? Anything changed in your relationships with the people you work with?
Well, to me, it's nice for me to get acknowledged for, like in the beginning of the interview, I said, you know, I knew I was kind of smart, you know, but I couldn't, there was no way I could use it. Well, it's like nice to be acknowledged for being able to be, articulate in some way, and the things that I think I'm pretty good at, and it's been 10 or 12 years. In the last 4 or 5 years, I could use those things because I'm a carpenter. Now I'm not like a dumb apprentice. I'm not an awkward craftsperson. I'm a carpenter now, and now I have a basis for people to respect me for other things as well. But unless I learn my trade, I'm not the greatest carpenter in the world, but I have a background, and I'm, you know, I think most people would be happy to work alongside me. I pull my weight, and that now I can be acknowledged with some other things that I think are that's in my relationship with the men. I think it's, you know, I think that it's, I feel more of an equal footing to them now.
You mentioned before that you have to find creative ways of fighting because of the sort of natural constraints that the role of steward in the Carpenters Union has. What are, I think that knowing you as I do, I think that's, you know, you are a creative person. What are some ways that you use your creativity in the steward role?
Well,
sliding.
I don't know, we had, I don't know, can't think of anything like extremely creative. I mean, we had several opportunities. We had some petitions going, and what I liked about that was that I didn't write the petitions. That, you know, that some of the men wrote the petitions, and it was circulated on 15 different sites, and in response to a worker being unfairly punished. And I think that management was pretty surprised that we would come to this guy's, that we would care. I don't know. I can't really think of anything. We started doing. we had a series of labor management meetings, which was unprecedented. They never bothered to, there was no, nothing like that since I did, and nobody had ever done that before in the shop, it's not like particularly creative, except for that nobody did it before, and we had a lot of the other trades started electing stewards, and then we requested meetings, and we got to sit with our recalcitrant or whatever that word is, bosses around the table as equals, which was informally discuss issues, and that was, it was not out of any natural setup that we had with the unions. It was really we really forced that to happen. Like, nobody wanted that to happen. Nobody really saw the point, but when we did it, it was good, because there we were, and we were equal to our bosses at that given moment. And we, you know, so we're trying to do these things. It's like reinventing the wheel, you know. It's trying to do these things to establish the fact that we are equals in this business, as in terms of, if we didn't have union representation, we wouldn't be equals, but because we have that, that equalizes it to some degree. And so that's, I don't know how creative it is, and we haven't done it recently.
Does it have a life of its own now that you started having them?
Well, our meetings have a life of their own, but the situation with management is very Byzantine, and I don't know, I find it very difficult to keep that going, because for that we really have to be better organized than with the other trades. The complaint that I've gotten from my union is that, why is it always the carpenters who are bringing these issues up? Well, I don't hear anything from the other trades, and that's sort of as if to say, what's wrong with you? And so it's difficult. I find it difficult. The other trades have, every once in a while, they'll sort of want, you know, make a big stink about, we should have a meeting for all the trades. Why is it just the carpenters? But, you know, my point is, well, that's great, but do something, you know. And it hasn't gotten off the ground to the point. I just feel like I feel like it's, each trade has to, they have to decide what they want to do, and they have to do something, that nobody's going to do it for them. And so it's sort of, it does sort of log jam around that, because they're not, the other trades are not really organized. And they can organize themselves, so then it becomes back to the carpenters are always the ones who are bitching and moaning and causing trouble. So it has not gotten off the ground in terms of the whole shop being organized, but there is to a certain extent there's a model set up. It's not a great model, but to a certain extent it is. And it's very possible that if there is an issue that's big enough, that it will coalesce around being organized, the shop being organized across trade lines.
You mentioned before that people in the Carpenters Union are sort of cynical, and some of that's led to apathy, and there's a lot of problems. What would you say are the biggest drags on making something happen?
Making something happen? In my shop?
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the biggest drags on making something happen is the competition and backbiting that is this atmosphere of dog-eat-dog atmosphere that management sets up, it's difficult. People, it is a divide and conquer thing. That's one big obstacle, and another is just not being afraid of being confrontational.
Have you developed different styles of being confrontational? You have different models that you use for work. What are some effective ways that you've found to be confrontational?
Well, what I've actually, I found... I found that actually being... best that I found is with the union and with management is writing letters, asking for meetings, and writing follow-up letters. It's not like exciting and creative, but it works a whole lot better than yelling toe-to-toe with your boss or your union rep, screaming at them, which I found does not work. And I always end up at a disadvantage. Not always. Actually, there are some times where it's totally appropriate to just absolutely let off, just rear up. I mean, there are times, but you have to be very, you have to use them very cautiously and not overuse it. Maybe once a year, you know, rear up and just let people know that you're not going to take shit from anyone. But the rest of the year, be very, I mean, it really, you have to be, I find, you know, being polite, writing everything down, writing letters, CCing them to people that count, taking minutes. These are very aggressive things to do and unarguable. I had situations where in a labor management meeting, I insisted that minutes be taken, and everybody, management, union, labor relations, just sat and looked at each other, and would not deal with that request. It was a powerful request, I realized, and I had to take the goddamn minutes. And to me, those are obviously, if this is such a curse on, you know, these people, then you know that it's an important thing to do. So I found keeping all of that stuff, and you end up with a very, very thick file documenting all your struggles and documenting a history of being consistent on issues, having worked through the channels that you're supposed to work through, and it builds, and it can be used if necessary to be taken outside of that structure. We didn't do anything like exciting and wonderful, but it's just what I found that, and it builds a lot of issues are like in the ozone. It's like, you know, they haven't accelerated and they haven't gotten worse, you know, because of what we've done, you know. We had a lot of issues around supervision, around who being supervised by incompetent management, you know. There was grievances on incompetent management. I mean, things like that.
So what kind of resolution did you have?
Well, we usually got satisfaction. I mean, basically, when we got explanations to our satisfaction of where our chain of supervision was supposed to be, and now there are always, you know, there are always gray areas, but we got the
guidelines,
which they weren't willing to, you know, demanded those guidelines and got them. So stuff like that, I don't know. I have a feeling that, I don't know, I just feel like we're kind of holding a line, really, more than making any big advances. But I think that's okay for now.
What kinds of things would you like to see happen realistically? That, like, things that you're working towards, you know, things you'd like to see happen.
Well, in terms of our union and union representation, I would like, because I feel this all, you know, I feel like one specific thing I'd like to see happen is to have some of the stuff that we're doing be put into, you know, be taken. Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is to have better union representation so that we don't have to do all the work. I mean, it's good, it's okay, but it does, I mean, we do need more backup for these things. So I'd like to see us have more backup. I'd like to see us have more response from the union. I'd like to be able to call the union up and have the union directly deal with something when we need it instead of having to go through all these, like, millions and zillions of, you know, of circuitous routes to our, you know, just basic stuff. I mean, I think, and we have, you know, a decent job. I'd just like it to stay decent. I don't know if there are other goals that I have that I don't have specifically to do with this type of organizing, you know. And I'd like to see our workforce be, I'd like to see more women in our workforce. I'd like to see more other kinds of people, you know, minority people.
Do you see the union playing a role in getting more women in?
Well, not in the structure I'm in, the civil service structure. It's very codified in this sort of this system of testing and qualifications that does not seem to have resulted in many women being part of that workforce. Unless something changes in that, it's not going to be that much different. I would like to.
What keeps women out?
I think what keeps women out is there's a 5-year experience requirement, which apprenticeship is not included in. So if that's talking about 9 years of, if you go the union route, it's talking about 9 years of full-time employment. And not, that's very difficult for women to achieve. If you're talking about non-union route, that's only 5 years because you don't have an apprentice status, so it's almost unfair that if you go the union route, you end up having to work 9 years. So I plus take a test. So I think that because of the nature of the industry and how difficult it is for women to get a foothold, difficult for anyone, but specifically difficult for women to get a foothold, I think that not that many women end up having those qualifications. And also there are other things too. The 1 out of 3, the city as employer gets to choose 1 out of 3 applicants who have gone through all this procedure and experience and testing. So often it's the woman who doesn't get chosen, and it's very discouraging. So even if you do all that stuff, there's a chance you won't get hired. And their jobs are very coveted jobs, and they are not easy to get. And there's a lot of subtle and not so subtle. But I think the biggest obstacle is to have all that experience, and also I think another obstacle is that there's a network of people who know about these things, who know about these tests, who know how to that system, and there's a lot of people who don't, and women they might not even hear about these things. So there's a lot of recruitment, training, and preparation that could be done. I think the whole thing could be revamped. Well, I think the union should do it, and the city. I think it should be a concerted effort to integrate the workforce. And I feel very strongly about that. I think it would be a nicer job for me, you know, and I think it'd be a healthier system if that could happen. I would love to be a part of that happening. I'd like to.
So,
thumbs.
Yeah. I think that's.
Yeah.
Well,
let's see what happens here.
I'm not sure if we did that right. Okay, so what were you going
to ask? Well, I wanted to ask you what, you were talking about the job and the worst aspects of it. Which
oh.
Human okay. And what's most important to you about it?
Okay. What I was trying to say is the job, my job, I feel like is a pretty good job as jobs go. It's a decent job. We get paid decently for our labor. We have decent hours. Conditions vary. The issue of being treated like a dog, dehumanizing by our bosses is one we think we're trying to, you know, we're dealing with okay. The issues of health and safety are, to me, are really important because it's a decent job, but we're in these indecent conditions a lot. We're working in all these different hospitals. We're working around asbestos. We're working around blood and urine and semen and vomit. This can be very horrible. It can, but mostly, to me, mostly asbestos is because that's the worst danger as well. We're also exposed to a lot of fiberglass and a lot of dust, toxic dust and everything. It's a job that's supposed to be a lifetime job. The accumulated toxic is very, you know, is very significant, and I think that it takes a lot of vigilance to work the job so that you have the least exposure. You have to work with shit, you know. That's the nature of it. That's partly, I guess, why one of the reasons we get paid well. So you can't, but to avoid the most. To avoid destroying yourself by the exposure. That to me is number one. I mean, I feel like, you know, when we open up a ceiling and all kinds of white dust falls on us and we're breathing it in, it's like a violation of my body that I don't think is worth the money if I'm going to die from it. So. You know, it's protecting ourselves against that. That to me is very important. And it's also, I think, the most important thing to my co-carpenters. That's what comes up the most. People are frightened, they don't know how to deal with it, and we're trying, right now what we're trying to do is, besides trying to get the training under the Right to Know law, which has been going, we've been trying to get for 2.5 years, basic training and basic stuff.
And you've made no headway?
Well, we have not yet gotten it. We have a lot of documented requests for it. We have a Department of Labor complaint in. We have had meetings on it. We've had petitions, and we haven't gotten it yet. Now, so that's like number one. And number two is proper protective equipment, and that's something that we've decided as a group that we have to research ourselves, since we don't have any training, and what masks are appropriate and what kind of protective equipment. Since we're not getting the training, that we have to find out what we need and just demand it. But we realize that we have to know exactly what we need to be able to demand it. We have asked for masks. We've gotten some in the past. We have never been properly fit tested or trained in using them. So, you know, it just goes on and on like that. But anyway, that to me is it's exhausting to just, but when we have made headway. I mean, people now almost unilaterally don't work. They know there's an asbestos condition. They used to work, now they don't. So, I mean, the management knows we won't. So, I mean, that's something.
I was talking to one carpenter today, and he said that in terms of health and safety, there's nothing to be done except getting it done. He said that construction workers are too macho. They don't want to give up the image that they're afraid. They don't want to play into the boss's hands by giving them grounds for laying somebody off because they, you know, they can't put up with the fear, and so they don't want to set themselves up. He was very pessimistic. Seems like you have a different experience.
Well, I think.
What do you think accounts for the two?
What I think accounts for it is that we have a job that is not seasonal. It's a year-round job. Even so, people are afraid of being. They're afraid of a lot of things, but they know they can't be laid off on a dime just for asking for a mask. They know they can be harassed by management. They know they can. One carpenter was trying to promote the idea that if we keep asking for protective equipment, then it will come out of our prevailing rate of pay that will be more expensive, and therefore our pay will go down. I mean, people, even if you have a job that is considered, nothing is permanent, but as permanent as you can get, people are still think that they can't really ask for this stuff. So, but we do, but I think what makes the difference is that we're, most of us, they've tried to fire people for health and safety in my shop, who are permanent workers. For health and safety issues, they've tried to make their lives miserable, which is another way that can get you to quit. But they can't. It's not easy for them to do it. So it just, we have a lot of our own fears and resistance and ignorance to combat, and that takes a long time. But we do have the time to do it. People are in these type of jobs for 15, 20, 30 years. So, I mean, that's why I'm a little more optimistic. You figure, you know, in 15 years, maybe you'll be able to make some progress. Most people don't have that opportunity to feel like you have 15 years to work on this, because, you know, you're on the outside, you'd be blackballed, and you'd have a very safe environment in front of the television set, you know, at home. Maybe that's not so safe.
That's not what Paul Verdure says. You mentioned this being exhausting. When you feel tired and you feel kind of burned out, like I suspect sometimes you might, what do you do to get support? Where do you go for help?
Well, actually, that's a good question. I call you. It's true.
Asbestos busters.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I try to do is just to forget about it. Go to a bar or something. As far as, you know, the community of support that I have in terms of job issues is, you. there's Hard Hat News, which is, you know, takes these issues seriously. Then there's, I don't know, is this like my, the person that I love who is concerned about this stuff and wants me to live a long time. and my mother, who's scared to death that I'm going to get killed by the mafia somehow. And, you know, she told me she didn't, you know, she's real scared. But I think she, on some level, I don't know how supportive she is of this union activity, but she is proud of me to a certain extent. So I mean, it's really those people and those things that, you know, that help me.
So the usual question that I always see at the end of every interview is, would you want your daughter to do this job? So I'm not going to ask you that job. I'm going to ask you.
Oh, good. Because you get a tirade.
Because I don't want to get a tirade. And I'm going to ask you, as far as other women.
Other women, yeah.
And what kind of words of advice do you have for other women who are entering into union work in non-traditional jobs?
I don't work with any other women, but I see women all over the city. I work all over the five boroughs, and I always, if they're at all interested or curious at all, I always try to talk them into thinking about a job like this. I'm constantly passing out numbers because I do think that these jobs, these union non-traditional jobs, these trades jobs, there are many, many advantages to women in getting these jobs over traditional women's jobs. And that's not for everybody. Not everybody wants to do it. Not everybody should. It shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be considered less worthy to be something else. But the money is good. The self-esteem that you can get if you stick it out is tremendous. The respect that you can get for it from others is rewarding, that there's so many reasons to go into it. The independence that you can have, not just in terms of your paycheck, but also in terms of going through life, knowing that you can do certain things that you've been told all the first part of your life that you couldn't do. I mean, I still have this two people inside me, you know, the femme, helpless femme, and the competent macho bitch, you know, I'm glad I have to say this on tape, which is not to sound like, you know, that I'm not a militant feminist, blah, 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 but I have learned a lot from the men I work with that to me is I am very grateful for, that I have had the opportunity to learn from men about their world, and which is now really my world too. And it feels very whole to me, you know? So I really encourage women to go into this, you know? I think that I see so many women in the hospitals who are aides and who are nurses and who are completely competent. They would probably be able to, you know, do this with flair and really would like to. So I think that it's just these hurdles you have to go through, but it's worth it. If you have the inclination and you have the desire to do it, it's really worth it. And I think that women can help to humanize this man's world, you know? I mean, not humanize like, I don't mean to say that women have these qualities and men have those qualities, but because I know bringing my experience as a woman to this job, I try to convince the men this is good for you too, and I think it's true. I think women can be can rejuvenate this industry.
And what about women in the labor movement? What about women in unions? What could they add to that?
Well, I just think that so many of the men have been worn down to and worn out that really, I mean, whether it's women or whether it's, you know, any kind of new blood who has still has a spirit and can look at the rhetoric that the union gives you and hold it to its own words, and you know, that's good. So I think women, in the sense of being newcomers, can challenge the union to do what they are supposed to do.
Right, like a rectification campaign.
Right, not because they're women, but because they're newcomers. And I think that in the union movement as a whole, since it really seems to be, from friends I've talked to, the pink collar and white collar and more women's areas that are becoming more unionized and blue collar areas are losing ground, that women seem to be the future or a big part of the future of this movement. And when I see clerical workers organizing into unions for the first time and taking it pretty seriously, and I see blue collar men making top, you know, very good pay, not taking the union seriously, you know, see a big contrast there, and you think, well, we could use some of that, you know. So I think that blue collar and white collar people should get together more often.
So for a woman who's setting out and becoming active in her union in a non-traditional job, vastly outnumbered by men. What few words of advice do you have for her?
For women, could you go over the scenario?
Getting active in your union, considering the possibilities of becoming a union activist in one sense or another. What words of advice would you have?
I just, unfortunately, maybe I'm getting old, but I think that you have to, like, have sort of pace yourself and have some stamina. It's easy to shoot your wad, as they say, like, and really ruin, you know, have to take years to recover. I mean, I think that you have to, like I said before in the interview, you have to be able to stand up and sometimes just really take a stand, uncompromised. But for the long run, you have to pace yourself, choose your battles. I know this has been said 100 times before, and be conservative. It's a conservative field, you know. It's not, you know, it's real easy to get to be on the outside looking in very short time, and you have to really weigh what you do and say, you know, if you want to stick it out for the long run. I know there should be, I mean, you need radicals and you need people who will take extreme stands. I think that it's very difficult to do that in our industry. Difficult anywhere, but it's, you know, it is difficult anywhere. I think that for women trying to be active in their union, I think you have, okay, this is my advice. It's going to take a while just to get yourself situated where you have your qualifications as a tradesperson. That's number one. That takes a while. You can't do it in 90 days. You know, you can learn during that period and you can take some kind of stand, you know, as you go. But really, that's primary. That's your source of income, you know? You know, so you have to pace yourself when you're beginning, and you have to learn from everybody that you can. And it's these little battles that you're going to win respect for, which I didn't when I was growing up in the trades, you know, because I didn't do it the way I'm advising other people to do it. I think that you have to win the respect of your fellow union members. You have to win the respect. You need them. You can't just be a wonderful person and stand up and say all the right things. You have to have support. You have to have people who will support you. You have to support them. And, you know, so all of this takes a long time, because especially since you're doing something you've never done before. You know, so that's how it goes. I think that's how it goes, and you have to earn respect. You don't just get respect. You have to earn respect.
Well, I have lots more questions, and I'd like to talk to you a lot longer, but we'll call it quits.
Okay.
Thank you.